So after the Neutral Zone, the final episode of the first season, you remember about the Romulans and we're back and blah, blah, blah. The second season featured the Romulans a total of, I think, one time.
And they were kind of incidental.
Decidedly lackluster episode. Incidental, I think, is a good word for it. So we have our first Romulan-centric episode in quite a while, and it is middling at best.
Yeah, it was at that. I like both of these episodes. I think there were a lot of points that I liked them a lot, but again, it's one of those.
They're
back to not being quite there.
They're just not. Well, I think they're not quite there in a different way, though. Because if you look at the enemy, you see an episode where all of the parts are there. I think Michael Piller's influence is very strong. I think he even wrote this episode, if I'm not mistaken, or co-wrote it. So it's much less about the plot and it's much less about the guest stars. It's more about how they impact our characters,
yeah.
Right? And the show is frankly, it's just different now. And I don't think it's going back. What I think the major problem with the enemy is, it's just that what's there is not quite baked. And it's not as it's not a bad episode by any stretch of the imagination. It's just a solidly okay episode of the show at this point.
Well, here's the thing. Like, I liked all of the B plots in this. And it's just the A plot kind of sucked. Because I think, as I said, I don't really like Geordi. And his entire...
Well, that's interesting. I mean, talk about that. Why don't you like Geordi? I mean,
there's no
probably...
reason to like him. Yeah. He's just kind of weird and awkward. And you even texted me about this. And, you know, at the part when he doesn't take the gun that was
right.
trained on him 30 seconds ago, it's stuff like that where it's just like, you fucking idiot. Like,
well, this is what
you could have solved this whole problem by being smarter.
Yeah, and I guess, well, this is the thing that I really want to talk about, though, because this is in a lot of ways Geordi's episode. And, you know, it sidesteps a lot of the issues that I think the episode could have fallen into, where, for example, the episode could have been about Geordi trying to get out of that cave in the ground, right?
And, yeah.
You know, we see, and I think what the issue here really is that the episode is trying to be about his technical abilities and his knowledge of engineering and his knowledge of science is not superior, but it's a different way to get the mission done, right?
Yeah.
And so what you see here is you see him figuring out that this thing that he melts, he can use as climbing spikes to get out of the hole in the ground. All right, cool. Then he encounters the neutrino pulse that Wesley sends down.
And he knows immediately that it's Wesley who did that, by the way.
Well, of course, because who else is going to send him a giant rod? and he's very excited sexually or whatever. I don't know. We don't need to go down that road, even though I just did. And so, you know, and then he gets in contact with the Romulan who holds him captive. And, you know, what I really think this episode is trying to say here is that, you know, if Worf had been down on this planet, it would have been a very different episode. If Riker had been down on the planet, it would have been a very different episode. Those are characters that are much more front-facing with their intent. They're much more militaristic, I think, in their attitudes. Worf just wants to kill things. Riker's a tactician, right? He's very good at strategy, both of those things. And, you know, whereas Geordi kind of approaches it from a different angle. He's a geek. He's a nerd. He's in Starfleet not because he is a military man, but because this is the best way for him to experience science and experience the unknown and use his engineering abilities.
It reminds me, I had a buddy of mine who joined the Air Force because he wanted to study, like, computers and, you know. That's why he joined the Starfleet, because he would be able to get to the best technology and the best and see it in action.
Yeah, and I think what you really see that's interesting here is there's always this debate in Star Trek circles that you probably don't know about, which is sort of like, is Starfleet a militaristic organization or not? And we've talked about it sort of. I think a lot more in the original series era we talked about it, and
we talked
about it a lot with sort of like the Nicholas Meyer movies and how he sort of made them much more naval in flavor and things like that. And I think this episode is one of the episodes that really goes in the direction of Starfleet is not a military. It has functions of the military, certainly.
Yeah.
But it is different in conception from what we would understand a military to be, that it is something else entirely.
No. I have been getting that sense, and especially I think part of it is that we have seen the culture kind of the galaxy evolve over the past couple of decades in from original series to now, and so maybe it was started as a military organization that gradually needed to become a little less military, or maybe in Next Generation we've seen the legal end of Starfleet, we've seen the medical end, we've seen all of these things. So I think we've seen the humanitarian and the peacekeeping as well as the military side. I mean, someone like Tasha Yar joined Starfleet because she wanted to become a soldier. You know, Worf joined because he figured that would, you know. So there is definitely a place for that. There is definitely, but it's not like that's why,
why they're out there.
Yeah, Dr. Crusher joined Starfleet not because she wanted to necessarily be a military doctor, but again, she probably figured this is the way I can get to the best technology, I can get the most interesting, patients, I can actually do something.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think in a lot of ways, we see this even with our own military. For example, The Army Corps of Engineers does a lot of civilian stuff, levees and things like that, bridges. And, that's all kind of par for the course, I think. And we sort of understand that as a function of our military. But, Starfleet is something that is just so different from anything that we conceive of as military that functionally, if the Federation does have a military, Starfleet is it. But Geordi, I think, is a perfect example of the fact that they don't get trained in military tactics. Because if Geordi had gone to their equivalent of, West Point instead of Starfleet Academy, I don't think that he would have neglected to take the gun from the Romulan, right?
I mean, which is fair, but at the same time, like, when that was happening, I was shouting at the TV, like, Geordi, take the fucking gun! And there is an amount of it where it's just, I'm the one watching the show, but It's one of those cliches that TV characters fall into that just doesn't make me think that well of him.
Yeah, I can see that argument, and certainly at the time that it happens, well, just take the gun. Like, what are you doing, right? But in the sense that,
of course, and he is, we do know that this is a very chaotic storm he's in the middle of. It's not.
Well, I don't even think it's that. I think it's more that Geordi. It doesn't occur to Geordi to take the gun because he knows the Romulan isn't going to shoot him. What we see of the Federation and what we see of Starfleet and what we see of Federation citizens, we see people that, are fundamentally good, and not only people that are fundamentally good, but people that think that other species are fundamentally good as well. Members of those species are fundamentally good. And so it doesn't occur to Geordi to take the gun because he's like, all right, well, you got to do this. So just do it. His instinct is to help the Romulan get away from the situation as opposed to get the tactical upper hand.
And his reaction, even when, the Romulan points the gun back at him, he's like, really? All right. No good deeds going unpunished. Like he does. I think he does feel like the Romulan's going to say, oh, you saved my life. We're best friends now, which ultimately is what happens to the two of them. Yes, it just takes a little longer than that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I guess, it's interesting because this episode hits all of the Star Trek themes by the numbers. It's essentially of two alien species learning to trust each other, and they quite literally have to supply the missing pieces to each other to act as one person in order to, solve their problem that they're in, And I will say, I groaned audibly when he said, I will be your eyes, that part. That was, it's the kind of stuff that works on paper and that you like to see Star Trek doing. It's just, it could have been done in a less cliche way, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think,
or less corny way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think, a large part of why this episode doesn't work is, we haven't talked about Tomalak and the Romulan ship, but there's a sense in the episode that Tomalak is hiding something. Obviously, he's hiding something because there's a second Romulan on the planet when he said there was only one. And
that's
that
right. They never really go into why what exactly they were doing, do they?
No, they don't. And I think the Federation, and that's kind of the point of the episode, I guess, is that it's not really important what they were doing.
No, it's some kind of stratagem that failed.
They're trying to do something. Who knows what they're trying
to do. The Romulans are up to their dirty tricks.
That's... Yeah, exactly. Romulans be sneaky. That's basically what you're supposed to get out of it, I think. But it doesn't, it, you know, the, I think the Geordi stuff is as good as it could have been, and I think it works fine. I think the Tomalak stuff doesn't work as well as it could have, and I think it's missing something. I don't know what it's missing, but I think there's a...
It's missing that they need to have revealed that they genuinely did lose navigation. Just, I think they need to have been on that planet demonstrably in good faith, like... He was lying about there being a second Romulan because he didn't want them chasing down and possibly killing that Romulan.
Yeah.
And but for the most part, like, yes, it was a two-man crew that their instruments did fuck up. They did just land on this planet completely mistakenly. It wasn't the Romulans trying to war. And this ship was trying to get in and get them out as quickly as they could without the Enterprise knowing.
Yeah, I guess that's really helping me to figure out what's wrong with it. I think in the same way that Geordi and the Romulan, whose name I forget because they all look the same,
yeah.
I'm a racist, learn to put aside their differences and their hostilities and their suspicions,
yeah,
and work together. I think what should have happened is that, you know, Picard and the Enterprise and Tomalak and his ship should have figured out to put aside their differences and work together and kind of like be honest with each other about their intentions of what was going on. And I think they do that a little bit, but they don't really do it in a way that's satisfying or a way that makes a lot of sense.
Again, the Romulans still look like they were up to something. The Romulans were still going to do something sneaky, and they still, you know, this attempt at whatever was thwarted, but they're still out there is where I'm left with, you know?
Yeah, I think so. And I think...
And it's at this point, they just gave amnesty to some people who are trying to work and destroy the Federation rather than just a couple of Romulan scientists who had mechanical failure.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem with this episode, too, is that you don't really get a sense of any of the Romulans as people.
No.
They're just sort of stock Romulans. And that, I think, is an issue.
They're original series Romulans. Almost.
Yeah, they are. And I think that's another reason why the episode kind of suffers, because The Next Generation didn't really have a strong conception of what the Romulans were going to be in the show. And I think this episode doesn't either. It's disappointing because I think the show has gone a long way towards making the guest stars and the alien races that they encounter feel more interesting. And I think you see that in you know, our other episode for this week, The Price, which, you know, we'll talk about in a few minutes. But it's just kind of like, who is Tomalak? Who is this Centurion? I don't know who they are.
I mean, we've seen... There are two moments where the Romulans really do stand up. One is the Centurion from Balance of Power, who is very strongly characterized, and that is the first time we see Romulans. And that final episode of the first season of Next Gen, where the Romulans see themselves as, you know, as daddy coming back, you know, to... They're the ones that they feel are the really civilized race of the galaxy, and they are the ones who will get order. And that's what Romulans are to me.
Right.
I like that conception of Romulans. It gives them an arrogance that's maybe not completely unearned, but it also makes them... They feel that what they're doing is a necessary evil in a way. They feel they're taming the galaxy just as much as the Federation feels it's taming the galaxy. I mean, that's the one thing that I think the franchise needs to get more into. The Romulans and the Federation are kind of even.
Right.
And... I don't, you know, they're kind of the new Klingons in a way. They could have been the new Klingons if the Klingons are part of the society. They imply in this episode that this may be the end game for the Romulans are going to be allied with the Federation in some way eventually.
Well, I think there's some interesting stuff there, partially because, you know, it was set up in the neutral zone as the Romulans are back. We're back. We came back. Why did they come back? They were gone for 70 years.
Yeah.
We don't know why they're back. And in the past year and a half, they've really had no explanation for that speech whatsoever.
Yeah. They were also they were introduced in the episode with a fairly large mystery. These colonies are disappearing or being destroyed. The Romulans know who did it. We don't. They still aren't talking about that.
Well, we kind of do.
Is it the Borg?
It's supposed to be the Borg, yeah. And that was supposed to have been made much more explicit because the Neutral Zone and Q-Who were supposed to come much closer together. But that obviously didn't happen. And I think that's something that can be missed quite easily.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that's what they were trying to do with that or if they if it was another... Because that isn't the first thing they've abandoned, those telepathic worm body snatchers. That was supposed to be another thing too. You know?
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, really the issue with the Romulans is that they have set them up as the villain of the show at this point. They don't use them very much, which is fine. I don't think that Star Trek is a show that needs villains most of the time.
I mean, what
they just basically they keep remaking Balance of Terror, only shittier.
And what they need to do, I mean, if that's the case, the Romulans know that the Borg are coming, right? So
I would assume so.
So the Romulans, who think of themselves as, again, the truly powerful ones in the galaxy, they're coming back to fight the Borg, and all they're doing is really they're setting up for that war. They don't trust the Federation to be able to handle themselves right now. So, I mean, really, that they, I think it's more interesting if it turns out behind the scenes that all of these sniping where the Romulans feeling like, oh, the Federation is fucking up our plans, you know, they can't be trusted to know what the Borg is really up to. So we're just trying to get them out of our hair while we set up our own defenses, you know, for the galaxy. I mean, the Romulans have to be thinking that they're the good guys here. The Romulans have to be thinking that they are the ones who are going to win against the Borg, and they are the ones who have to fight the Borg. They think it's their responsibility.
It's interesting where you take this stuff.
Thank you.
And that's all I'll say about it.
Okay.
Yeah, and I guess at the end of the day, the sort of, I guess, reveal, if you can call it that, that Geordi and the Romulan were working together to get off the planet, and Tomalak says, oh, okay, well, everything's cool then, and they just go their separate ways, is very anticlimactic, and the episode doesn't really have much of an ending. It just sort of, it's some stuff that happened. Nothing really felt all that important. I know that Picard sort of used Galorndon Core as some sort of, you know, let's not make it a rallying cry like Pearl Harbor or Station Salem 1. What is that?
I know you've made fun of that kind of thing, you know.
It's the sci-fi.
A writer like your Shakespeare or the Klabongans, you know, Zerbat 6, you know.
But it's the sci-fi reference rule of three, only this time it's two, right? You say two real things and one fake thing. So people know what you're talking about. I guess everybody, they couldn't think of anything else. I don't know. And also I thought it was weird because it was like, well, Pearl Harbor was a sneak attack and we don't know what Station Salem 1 was. And I don't think we ever find out. And it's not really that important. We can assume that, I don't know, maybe space pilgrims were killed in a fire. I don't know. Let's go with that. And then this also would happen because this is not a sneak attack. So what exactly is, what is Picard's point exactly? I don't know.
Let's listen. This was a, There were a lot of poor writing in this episode.
Yeah, which is a shame.
I liked the... And I here's the thing. So I liked the what Worf is going through for this episode. Here you have again...
Oh, yeah, we haven't even talked about that. I completely forgotten that subplot.
That, well, because the episode forgets that subplot, too. They let that off the hook, really. And it's an interesting dilemma for most of the episode that just gets dropped. I mean, you have Worf who is legitimately struggling where, you know, he – and yes, it's very convenient that he's the one person on – you know, but fine. He can save this guy's life and, you know, he's refusing to do it. And Picard, who makes it very clear, look, I can order you to do this, but I don't want to. Mm-hmm. But – and Worf decides not to, and then he dies. And then – and the Romulan captain seems to not really be worried about it at the very end of the episode.
Yeah, I think he's
still
a little,
lost his officer.
Yeah, I think that's a little strange. I think the Romulan doesn't take it as seriously as perhaps he should. I want to defend it a little bit because I think that the point is there. And I think the point is that, you know, when you put aside your differences and when you decide to work with your enemy, quote unquote, you will get out alive. And that's what happens with Geordi and the Centurion. When Worf keeps his hatred of Romulans because they killed his parents, then the Romulan dies. And he may have caused some diplomatic snafu with the Federation and the Romulan Empire.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what the point is
supposed to be. Well, see, where I thought it was going to go with that, because, I mean, they do make it, you know, I and again, Star Trek on paper, you have Picard saying, you know, I know you don't want to do this, but I have to make, you know, all these decisions every day. And
right.
I, you know, that's, he literally quotes that, you know, the needs of the many and the needs of the few. And I need to worry about the needs of the many and what that's what my decisions are for. When the Romulans said, you know, I would never pollute myself with, you know, Klingon filth or whatever, I thought at that point, okay, then Worf's going to turn around and say, all right, Doctor, I'm ready. You know, put my blood in him. A little out of spite because he realizes that this bothers the Romulan as much as, you know, to receive his blood as much as it does him, you know. And they'll still be even, you know what I mean? Like, I think he doesn't... Worf doesn't want to be submissive to the Romulan. That's a...
I think you're misreading it. I don't think it's about submission at all. I think he just... He's holding a grudge. I mean, that's what it is. And so there was no way that Worf was ever going to allow his blood to be used to save the Romulan's life.
I thought that might change his mind because he could realize that he can really... Letting the Romulan die is going to be one thing. Letting him live knowing that a Klingon saved his life would be even more of a humiliation for this Klingon. And I thought that's where they were going.
For the Romulan, you mean?
For the Romulan, yeah. And I thought that's how they would be able to give Worf the higher ground on this while still remaining true to that belief.
Yeah, but I think it's a misreading of the episode that the episode is interested in giving Worf the high ground here. I think the episode is very explicitly giving Worf the shitty, selfish position. And I like the fact that the Romulan dies because I think the episode could have very well have just kept him alive to be beamed over to Tomalak's ship and be saved. And the fact that he dies is something that the show doesn't do that much, number one. I mean, he's not a main cast member or anything, so it's not like it's that shocking. It's, you know, random guest star of the week. But I like the fact that it's very understated. It's very quiet. It's just, this is what the consequences look like when you let your hatred get the better of you.
And that's fair. But I don't know.
But on the whole, it's, you know, it's a solid maybe 5 episode for me.
Yeah, I'd say that. It's a 5 blood episode.
5 blood. Okay, 5 very good.
Blood.
All right, well, let's move on to The Price.
So they really are not doing a great job with these titles. And you know exactly what they wanted to do with these, right? Like,
no, tell me.
They wanted, so, you know, this episode's called The Enemy.
I'm all ears.
Who's going to be an enemy of who? Oh, my God, what's the enemy going to be? The price. What are they paying for? What's it going to be? Oh, but the thing is, they're so generic that it's not even, you know, intriguing. Like...
So you
hear a title like the Corbomite maneuver. Okay, what the hell is Corbomite? You know, I'll find that. You know, they just staying one word and having us wonder what it's gonna be is not a good.
Yeah, this is not a great run of titles for the show because we have the enemy, the price. I think next week we have the Vengeance Factor,
which at least is
All right, and I think after that comes the Defector. Before that, we had the Bonding. The only one that doesn't fit into this pattern is Booby Trap, and I guess I just didn't want it to be the Booby Trap because that sounds ridiculous. Trap. Yeah, I'm with you.
You're right. Booby Trap is so much a classier title. You know, that really...
I mean, at least it's memorable. I just think this
so memorable.
Definite article with, like, vague one noun is just not a very good way to name your show. And I mean, frankly, like, I've seen these episodes many times, and, you know, I'm sitting here, and I'm like, okay, what do we have to do for the podcast this week? The Enemy and the Price. What the fuck are those? I have no idea. And as soon as I start watching them, I remember, but...
I mean, you give it almost like Friends naming titles, like the one with the wormhole that they're selling, or, you know, the one with the Romulans on the electricity planet, you know, like...
That would be worse, I think, but good job. I like the spirit and the
one where Ross and Deanna Troi beam down and get trapped, and Phoebe's all like, oh my god, a transporter!
Yeah, We need to talk about Troy.
I'm ready.
What the hell are they doing with her character?
They just don't know.
Because the guy in this episode.
And you know they really wanted to get Okana for this.
No, I don't think they did.
I do.
I'm not trying to ascribe motivations to the people that wrote these episodes, but it just seems like really creepy misogynist bullshit. Like, Loud as a Whisper was the first time that I noticed this, where she has this guy who is being very, very, very insistent that he take her out on a date, and she does not seem pleased, but she does it anyway because I don't know. And then in this episode, we have the guy who's, what the hell is his name? Kal-El or whatever? Superman? I don't know.
Do you know who I am? Why are you asking me
what
a character name is? I don't even know. Like, I'm glad I know Picard. I am really lucky I know. You are so lucky. I'm not just calling everybody Kirk.
Maybe you should do that. It would make for a very confusing podcast.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to understand, like, that's what I just think of every I just, when I watch the show, I see William Shatner.
So you think, like, bald Kirk.
Yes.
Kirk with a beard.
Kirk with the visor, yes. 16-year-old Kirk.
Kirk. Klingon Kirk.
Lady Kirk.
Lady Kirk. Other Lady Kirk. Okay, all right.
Whoopi
Gold Kirk. That could have gone in a very different direction, and I'm glad it didn't.
Kirkberg.
We've got this guy Rawl who appears, and you know we'll talk about the wormhole stuff because I think it's interesting. But and he immediately latches onto Troy. Okay, Troy is very pretty, and you know she's got low cut things on and stuff. And all right, fine, great. You know,
and as it's revealed, he's part Betazoid, and he knows that she is. And all right, I can see that.
Okay, fine, that's fine. You know, great. They're the two, you know, Polish people on the ship, and they want to, you know, eat pierogies together. That's fine. But there's a strain of stuff in our culture which says that women who are not interested in men can approach women in public whenever they want and hit on them and call them out and catcall them. And when women are at bars, you know, if you're not with a man, then you're like, you're goods and you're up for grabs. Right. And you have to, there's this thing about women who, you know, they lie. When men who they're not interested, you know, women go out, they want to eat alone. They, you know, what they're people, right? And they just want to go to the bar sometimes and have a drink and read their book. And men come up and they're like, hey, you have tits, let's fuck. And the women are like, oh, I have a boyfriend. And there's a thing about that, which, you know, on feminist blogs where they're like, you know, you shouldn't do that. You should say, look, I'm not interested, go away. I want to read my book or whatever. And I really feel like these episodes, Troy in particular, with Troy in Loud as a Whisper and now in The Price, that. Men, this is basically the show doing that to Troy, where she's like, you know what? I just want to fucking eat a chocolate sundae. Can you leave me alone? But she's not allowed to say it because she's a woman. And it really bothers me. And you know, it's just like, I didn't notice this stuff when I was a kid, but now it's like really blatant. And it's just, it's really, really upset. It's just weird and creepy, and I don't like it.
I would say a lot of that has to do with the fact that this is not a really great relationship between the two of them, and it's based on a lot of lies and them trying to outmaneuver each other for the most part. This is a relationship that is not
done on good terms.
If this had been some... I don't...
But Troy doesn't seem interested in these men, and that is my problem with it. She just, I don't know if it's Marina Sirtis' performance or her acting choices, but like she seems fundamentally disinterested in these men that are chasing her, but she seems like it's her duty to go out with them for whatever reason because she can't say no because she's a woman. That's the impression that I'm getting from her.
May I be honest?
Yeah.
I think part of it is that because if you looked at the script for it, I think it would have felt a little more natural between the two characters.
Yeah, maybe.
And I don't necessarily feel like Marina Sirtis is really okay with this. I think she's kind of your opinion that, you know, that I think she may have thought reading the script like, God damn it, but Troy would really just want that fucking Sunday. Like, she wouldn't, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because Troy is a bit more...
It would be one thing if she was like, you know, we've seen Riker in like Up the Long Ladder and all these episodes where he's just like macking on women and the women are like, all right, let's do it. If Troy was like that, I would have no problem with it whatsoever.
Well, because she's acting a lot more...
reticent.
Yeah, in a way that number one doesn't really work for her. I mean, this is, again, when we've seen Troy be a little more open about love. Again, the episode where she's betrothed to this guy and the way she acts with him and Riker, you know, makes it clear that, you know, when she's with someone, you know, she enjoys, like, that's not really a thing to her. Like, it's all right. You know, that's something that's acceptable. You know, well, she's not a frigid person.
Well, I think if you go back to the first season episode, I forget the name of it, but the one with the plague ship and the guy, and they were like, you know, and her mother came, and or not her mother. Was it her mother? Yeah, her mother. Was that Haven? That was Haven, right?
That's the one I was with where she was the one she's engaged to be married to.
Right, right. And I think that's interesting because I think that's a situation where both of them are not exactly sure of what's going on and both of them are not really, like, into this, right? And so the episode into this direction where eventually they start to get into it.
Because I think they realize that they are equally nervous.
Right.
For lack of a better word. I mean, it's a bit more complex than that. But they both have as much mixed feelings, so they kind of feel... I got the sense in that episode they don't nearly need to hide from each other because they know they're equally awkward about
Look,
this.
What I'm saying is the price is making me long for Haven.
For a Steven, yes. Oh, God, at the beginning when she's getting the letter from her mother, I thought that's what this episode was going to be.
Oh, aren't you glad it wasn't?
I am so glad it wasn't.
And I guess, you know, putting that sort of stuff aside, I think, you know, Rawl's relationship with her is very mercenary. I don't get a sense that he actually likes her. I mean, certainly he would like to fuck her because what heterosexual man wouldn't want to fuck Marina Sirtis?
You get the sense that, you know, again, she's a pretty woman. She, you know.
Or lady, you know.
She's a lady.
No, I'm saying ladies might want to, you know, get in there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say no.
I would say no, but I would be very...
You would say
I would
no,
be very,
thank you.
Yes, I would be very grateful that she appreciated my body.
No, thank you. I have a boyfriend.
Yes. That's what I would say.
I mean, that scene when he's talking to Riker, and I love that scene when he's talking to Riker because Rawl or whatever his name is, every time he's talking to anybody, he knows he has the upper hand. And he just plays Riker so fucking wrong, because I think he really does underestimate Riker. He thinks that he's going Riker.
Yeah, he does. Absolutely.
He thinks Riker is just, all right, well, this isn't easy. I just set up a jealousy trap and, you know, I talk about sleeping with his ex-girlfriend and he'll get so upset.
He'll fly off the handle.
He'll get so mad. And, you know, I think it says a lot that Riker is that guy who he probably isn't loving this conversation, but at the same time, I mean, he knows Troy very well. He knows that Troy is ultimately not going to get into a situation that she won't be able to get out of. You know, in other words,
right.
this guy, even if this guy turns out to be a complete snake, she's not going to be rooked that far from him. And which she doesn't, you know, at the end of
the
episode.
No, she calls him out on his shit, of course.
And
but
I think Riker also says, like, look, if you are with her right now, basically, you've lucked into a woman who is much better than you deserve. Like, you've gotten with someone who is so out of your league, you better fucking pray you keep her. Because, you know, and I think, you know, because she's going to make you, I mean, I think he all but says, like, she's going to make you a better man by being with her. Like, she is... You know, you can't be with this woman without being honest and without being a good person, and you need to change because, you know, and I think at that very end, after the plot happens and he goes to her, the way he's talking to her, I think he's starting to realize that maybe he did this initially as a dalliance, you know, maybe he thought he could use her. I think Riker's advice does sink in a little, and I think he's trying, you know, desperately, like, okay, well, I fucked up this negotiation, but maybe I haven't really tanked things with, you know, with Troy, and, you know, I can, and she rejects him, and I think the show kind of makes it clear, like, this is, he's going to stay a sleaze.
Well, yeah, but I guess.
Not faulting her for that, because she is well within her rights, because he is a sleaze.
I
want to make that clear, but I also think that While it may not have been this, you know, grand, you know, passion for the ages, you know, this could have been something that could have been good for the, for him, for them.
Well, I think, I mean, like, I have a couple problems with that. I think number one, I, you know, like you said before about, you know, reading on the page very different from, from how the episode is actually put together. I think that's spot on. And I think, you know, he may have, if you just read the script for this episode, Rawl may come across as a guy who's actually really interested in Troy. But also has this sort of hidden past and is kind of feeling vulnerable around her because she's a Betazoid and he can tell her that he's a Betazoid, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But what I get out of this episode from how it's actually filmed and performed is here's a mercenary guy who's a real sleazeball who is frankly being extremely, extremely sexually aggressive towards a character who does not seem at all interested in it. I would not place it out of the realm of possibility that he would rape her.
Well, they and, make it clear that there is that one conversation where she, I mean, says to him at one point when they're having dinner, she calls him out and she says, you know, you're telling people all everything they want to hear. You know, you're using – and he explicitly says to her, well, that's what I did with you and it worked. And
Yeah,
which is like –
it's like classic abuser stuff.
And she is not at all happy with that. Like, and she reacts appropriately to that. And
but notice how he like powerful mans her because like she, you know, he comes to her quarters and I noticed this. He comes to her quarters and she's dressed up and she says, what do you want for dinner? And he kisses her and she's like hands at her sides. She's very still. She does not seem into it at all. He does it again. Then she's like, oh, no, I'm going to do this. I don't know why. Because she feels, I guess, that she needs to do it because he's a man. Order champagne. And he said, champagne for two. And she's like, oh, yeah.
He is seducing her. I think she's not.
He's not seducing her. He is being a creepy stalker is what he's doing. This is not seduction. Is there anything seductive about what he's doing at all?
No. But he does end. He does end up in a dalliance, let's call it, with her. He does end up sleeping with her in a way which, while, you know, you said I can – definitely he did some deception there, yes, and he was not honest. But I don't think what he did – what he did doesn't fall under rape, I wouldn't say.
No, I'm not saying he actually raped her. I'm just saying that the episode as presented is using female sexuality in a very, very – sexist and anti-feminist way.
I don't disagree with
and
that
if
at
you
all.
Compare it to Riker, right? Compare it to Riker with his all his ladies. He's very charming. He comes across as a man who respects women, who respects their agency, who knows that they're their own people, doesn't have to sleep with them if he doesn't want to. He has to really try to impress them and try to say,
no,
you know, I'm going to be a fun time. You know, I'm going to be out of your system in a week, so let's just have a good week. He does that all the time, and the women respond to it. The women seem like they're into it. You know, they dress sexy for him.
Yeah.
They don't act like dead fish like Troy is. And that's all great. You know, male sexuality is something that's celebrated in our culture, and being aggressive and all that kind of stuff is, you know, these are things that our culture really likes. And especially, I think, if you look at the time frame that this was in, you know, of course, we're 20 years later, but, you know, the original series had this as well. But I think it's interesting that Riker is kind of the Kirk of this show in that sense. But in the original series, it was much more sexist. And in this one, you're seeing Riker go after fully realized women who are capable of their own thoughts and emotions and their own agency. And
I was going to say, he has the ideal woman created in the holodeck for him.
Right.
She has her own agency and she is
intelligent
and all of that. Yeah.
And I think the show just hasn't gone far enough to say, okay, well, the men that are pursuing these women, the women cannot be these sort of, you know, real doll character, basically. But when one of our main characters who's a woman has a sexual dalliance, we go back to 1965. And I don't know why that is.
I would even say that because, I mean, the original series even did have moments. Again, Edith Keeler is you cannot say that she was a real doll character. She was a fully realized character. She was probably one of the most significant Kirk love interests, you know, and she is a very realized person.
Absolutely.
And they have a much more of a give and take relationship than, yes, again, and there's.
And also, you forgot about the scene where Troy and Beverly Crusher.
Well, I was just about to talk about that scene because
are doing jazzercise. and they're talking about boys.
Okay, I have to say
what
that
the
was,
hell is that?
That scene was horrible.
It was awful.
What are they doing? I know. It was. I know this was like the
they're girls and they're gonna
this is the Jane Fonda.
They're flipping their hair back and forth and they're helping each other.
You're
stretch.
Looking a little unusually limber today, Troy. Well, Beverly, it was raw. You know,
they're all doing that. Hey, girl, let's talk about your boyfriend.
What a week, girl.
Are they supposed to be 14 all of a sudden? What are they doing?
I never. Here's the thing. Like, did.
Were they ever friends?
Yeah, that was my question! Like, I could see... See, and here's another thing. Like, I could see Dr. Pulaski and Troy having that conversation.
Sure,
because
they would not be doing that.
They would not be doing jazzercise.
They would probably be drinking in 10 Forward, because that's what Pulaski liked to do.
Yeah.
Good for her.
And
but
it would be a bit... It wouldn't be as silly of a conversation, but the two of them have been shown to have had that level of intimacy, at least. You know, that's who... And, you know, yes, it's not impossible that they're retconning that relationship onto...
All right.
Sure.
Fine.
But, yeah, it just... I don't know. It was weird to see Dr. Crusher in a leotard.
This show has a problem with women. That I'm calling it out.
Okay.
I don't know what it is about this show that has a problem with women. I don't know why it's gone backwards, but it's got a problem with women. And, frankly, I think that scene, more than anything else... really shows what the hell was the point of bringing Dr. Crusher back. She has not done a goddamn thing.
No.
Character-wise. Pulaski was certainly a much more interesting character than Beverly Crusher has been so far. And, you know, scenes like that make me miss Pulaski.
I grew to really like Pulaski. Like,
I mean, certainly I don't think that she was the greatest character ever, but in the same way that, you know, if Tasha Yar hadn't left the show,
again,
I think the show would have made her a very strong character by the third or fourth season.
I can extrapolate where Pulaski was at the end of that season versus where she was at the beginning.
And what I like...
She was growing to be a very... And give her another season, give all the other characters, you know, just as we're giving everybody another season.
And what I liked about Pulaski is that she was an older woman who was very capable. You know, also obviously had a sex life. I mean, she had a thing with Riker's father.
And with Worf.
And with Worf, you know, they were probably going to fuck at some point.
If they didn't in the tea ceremony. Like, there was, again, that if they did, if that scene was not symbolic of sex, it was definitely a very strong intimacy between the two of them. And that's, you know, that is not unerotic.
And so for me, it's just kind of this very missed opportunity where they could have had a very interesting female character that they just got rid of for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I don't know why they got rid of her. I don't really understand it, but I've never really heard any explanation for it whatsoever that makes any sense. But I don't know. I just feel like the characters that I'm responding to in this watch, because I've never really watched the show from the beginning straight through.
Like,
it's like, it's interesting to me because it's like, I've always liked Beverly, but now I'm just kind of like, I don't know why
same.
I liked her.
And I want to say, like, it makes me, Troy is acting very uncharacteristic and Crusher doesn't seem to be as worried about this as she should be.
But why should she be worried about it? I mean, they don't know each other. They're not friends.
And I guess so. Why are they, maybe that's, I don't know.
Maybe they're the only two people on the ship that like to do the weird tandem yoga they're doing. I don't know what they're doing, but
it's sad that's it seems like they only had that conversation because they're the only two female characters.
That's
around.
Pretty much it. That's
yeah.
And that's really unfortunate because, you know, the show had Tasha Yar, who, of course, would not have done that. The show had Pulaski,
you know,
who
they
would
might
not have,
done
that. And now I feel like they have the two girly characters and they're just going to have them be, you know, girls together and talk about boys all the time and do each other's hair.
And
it's
I have to say, I could have seen Tasha Yar having that conversation. She would have had a very different take on it.
She would have,
at the same time, she definitely would have been an all right person to talk about, like, gee, I've suddenly met this dude and we're boning like crazy. Like,
it's
Tasha Yar could have handled that conversation.
It's just this thing where men, and I you know, both of these episodes, the Enemy and the Price were written by men, that they just don't get female sexuality and they don't know how to write it in a way that doesn't come across as extremely sexist. You know, because in The Price, we had the chancellor, whoever, who was in charge, you know, the Acomarians. You know, she was a woman who was in charge of the negotiations for this wormhole. She was certainly capable. There was there, you know, no one was judging her. She wasn't sitting around doing jazzercise and talking about boys, but she wasn't sexualized at all, in any way. And it's like, as soon as women in this show become sexual beings, they become, you know, 15-year-old girls.
Well, that's it. They're able to write competent leader, you know, female leaders. And I like that we've seen, it hasn't been completely half and half, but we've seen plenty of planets in this series who do have a female leader. The Protovulcan one, I think, on the other day had, you know.
Yeah.
There have been.
Absolutely.
There have been plenty of examples from that. That's very good. Even the closest they've had to a sexualized leader that was the Irish lady, you know, who had the thing with Riker. And here's, again, another thing where he's not looking for somebody who is going to be, you know, submissive to him in any way. You know, she gives his, even though she is doing all the domestic things, she is doing, you know, she is giving as good as she's getting.
Sure.
She, you know, she is. And so I don't know. They, maybe it's just, maybe it is really just mostly Troy. Like,
I will say, I don't think that, you know,
Troy gets the worst of it. Let's leave it. Let's say that.
Yeah, I think so. And I do want to say, I don't think this is something that is limited only to Star Trek The Next Generation. I think that television in general has always had a problem with having female
media
characters that
general.
Are yeah, that are sexual, but also adult and mature and have agency. Right. This is not just a problem with this show. I guess we should talk about the wormhole. I don't think it's the more important part of the episode, but
no, and it's a MacGuffin.
It's a MacGuffin. It's a way for them to get Rawl on the ship, basically, and Rawl is the point of the episode in a sense. I do like the fact that the Federation doesn't win, and I like the fact that it's done in such a way that it's this false prize, because of course the wormhole is not what they think it is, and now the chameleons or whatever,
something alien,
right, they have this, the rights to this now useless wormhole.
And the Ferengi get the use of it too. Overall, I like the way that he loses. I think he loses in a good way. You know, he does say through the, I don't know. It's interesting.
Even when you win, sometimes you lose.
I do like the scene when he is talking to her and, you know, to Troy, and he's saying, you know, look, yes, I'm, you know, and she's saying, like, you're using this to get an edge. He's like, yeah, this is. He does view this kind of as a game. He is viewing this at, and I think a lot of people who are business people on a very high level do kind of view it as a game.
Oh,
as
absolutely,
you know?
They do.
And
yeah.
So, yes, maybe he's doing some and stuff that he would even admit is underhanded, but it feels, at the end of the day, we're all just trying to do what we can. And when he says to her, like, look, you're not telling people, you don't always tell people you're an empath, you know, and you're using things in a firefight. Like, people will die because of things, you know, all that's happening is someone's losing money, you know, whatever. And, you know, and he does say, like, I am a good loser. Like, if I don't win, I don't win, you know. And I think he has more integrity in business than I think.
Well, I think here's the link between the two. I think in the same way that he won Troy, but then lost her because he was lying. He won the wormhole negotiations, but then lost them.
Yeah, and in both cases, I don't think it's defeat.
I don't think it's a strong link.
No.
But it's there, at least. And I think the show is at least trying to link its A and B plots together in some way that it hadn't been in the past.
Yeah.
What do you think about the Ferengi in this episode?
I liked the Ferengi in this episode. This is one of the first contexts we've seen the Ferengi in a way
that
in which they're very effective in this kind of context, because there's a deal to be made. Of course the Ferengi are going to be sniffing at the edges of it. Like, sure. Like, I didn't expect them to show up, but when they did, I thought, yeah, a fucking course, you know, they want in on this, you know, I like how they get up, you know, but they're, and I like, I don't know. I they're not the villain of this episode. They fuck up a lot of stuff. They're doing a lot of things wrong. They're completely untrustworthy. But I think, but that scene when they come by and Picard just goes into his quarters and just sighs, like,
yeah.
At this point, the Ferengi are not the big bad. They're a really major annoyance.
Yeah, I think that's
and
it. Yeah.
I think that's good. That's how they're effective, because they're really good at just.
They're really good
at being another complication, because this episode was complicated enough without them.
Right. They're very good at being annoying, basically. Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, you know, the interesting thing about the Ferengi in this episode is that you see them as having guile, but you see them as having guile in a different way than we've seen them have guile in the past, because of course they had this sort of like, you know, secret thing going on with Rawl about how they were going to, you know, put on this performance, and then of course it turns out that everything is useless.
Yeah.
And also the fact
they
lose their two guys too, so that's not good. I mean, they're floating around in the Delta Quadrant now, so who knows what the hell's going to happen with that.
Oh my god, do they pick up that story in Voyager?
I don't know.
That would be great.
I did want to mention, you know, this concept of quadrants is just pay attention to it, because it does become kind of a thing.
I kind of figured like it means like really, really, really far away. Like I assume we're in, let's call it Alpha Quadrant, and it's just kind of as...
Yeah, well...
You know, it's some part of the galaxy, and whenever they talk about being at a quadrant, it's...
Well, a quadrant is 1/4. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, but it's also Star Trek, so it doesn't really have
to. No, actually it does. There's like a thing now. Like it's like the galaxy is divided into 4 quadrants, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and Delta.
Yeah, okay.
And the Federation is mostly in the Alpha Quadrant with a little bit in the Beta Quadrant.
Okay, so it's like catty corner to where they are, I'd assume.
Yeah, it's kind of like diagonal. Yeah,
yeah I assumed that from context to mean pretty much the opposite end of the galaxy.
Yeah, that's pretty much right. I mean,
it's 80. They mentioned right. 80 light years, you know.
Yeah, so those Ferengi are just, they're not coming back.
Yeah.
I think, you know.
I liked the negotiation parts.
Everything that wasn't Rawl and Troy was okay. Yeah. And the problem was that Rawl and Troy was the A-plot of the episode.
Well, that was the same thing with, you know, poor Geordi. You know, again, I liked everything that was not Geordi's plot. But unfortunately, and that's the thing. Like, if you're going to make an A-plot that's a MacGuffin.
Making an interesting one.
Yeah.
Or make it one that's not so
I thought the
creepy.
Stuff around this wormhole was interesting. I think it... I like that we get two, you know, new alien races that are characterized as similar enough, because both the guy with the Indian looking sounding guy with the weird head is, you know, supposed to be another neutral scholar race.
Sure.
And I love that the way he gets to them is there's going to be so much paperwork, and he freaks the fuck out at that. Like, I thought that was a really funny scene. I liked that. I like that he's representing this race that is officially neutral and is willing to employ the most, you know, snake-like guy that we've met, you know, who's... I think it's interesting that they're screwing kind of everybody over while still remaining neutral. I think that's a very interesting, because they talk about how they're neutral, they're peace-loving, you know, and all of that. That doesn't make them good.
Right, it doesn't.
The Federation is not neutral, but they're good.
Right. And I think that's kind of the difference there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I like parts of this episode, but the Rawl and Troy stuff is just so problematic for me that I can't in good conscience give this a good... because of that...
Yeah.
I think I'm giving this episode my first 0.
Really?
Yeah, I found it that objectionable.
Okay.
So it gets 0 Zol Rawls.
0 Zol Rawls.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm really too scared to rate this episode, so I think we should just move on with our lives.
Okay. Well, next week we are talking about the Vengeance Factor and the Defector.
Okay. So no more Limber Troy.
No more.